All right. So, JD, over to you, bro.
Okay, so it's Justin Dare again, Durant's Corner Radio, and
Gordo Byrne. This week, it's official. We're sponsored by Coffees of Hawaii.
We are officially sponsored by Coffees of Hawaii. So log on there, put in the code EC, right?
EC, 20%
discount. 20%
discount
with the code EC on
checkout.
At checkout.
Okay. Capital E, capital C. All
right.
I got beans in the kitchen for you if you need them.
That's right.
Okay.
Today we're sitting with world famous running coach Bobby McGee. Hails from another country. Which country?
South Africa.
South Africa. All right. So we brought him in. No, I'm just kidding. He lives in Boulder.
just for you.
Flew him in. We got a big budget here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've listened to Bobby talk, both in a group setting and in one-on-one settings. And I can guarantee you that through listening to him, you not only leave being educated, but you're also fired up. And sometimes you don't even know what you're fired up to do. You're just fired up to do something. In his case, it's probably wanting to fire up people to do running. now, having said that, I'd like to just kind of go through his background a bit and let him talk about himself through my questions, as opposed to just sitting there and having to talk to yourself. So why don't you tell us where you're from and how you eventually got over here?
Okay. Well, I was born and raised in South Africa, and pretty much, I don't know if you guys have read the book, The Power of One by Bryce Courtney. It speaks of, you know, growing up in Southern Africa and amongst the Swazis and amongst, you know, the local folks, and it was very much an outdoor way of growing up, you know. So it was really, you know, running was always there, bikes were always there, water was always there, although I never was a very good swimmer. But in terms of my professional approach, I think I ended up going to university to study sport because it was the best thing I did at school. You know, I was a fair rugby player, I was a fair cricketer, I was a little bit better than fair field hockey guy and a cross country and a track kid. So when my father said, what's your best subject? I said sports. So I studied phys ed. And then very lucky very early on to figure out I was never going to be a superstar at anything, you know. Pretty much like Ian Anderson realizing he's never going to play the guitar like Eric Clapton, so he'll play something arbitrary. So I was very quickly thinking of coaching, and studied phys ed, and then did postgrad work in exercise physiology and sports psychology.
Did you just do all your studying in South Africa?
All my studying in South Africa, okay. At the University of Stellenbosch, yeah. Then very quickly got involved with high school track, high school cross country, and then some senior athletes started asking me to take care of them, and ended up coaching a national record holder at 1500. So the middle distances were where I started with the coaching.
And for those who, what encompasses middle distance for the triathlete-minded folks?
Pretty much 800 to 5,000 meters. You know, okay. Some people will still consider the 5,000 as a distance run, but somewhere between there. You know,
okay.
Mostly 800 and 1,500, but the steeplechase is in the middle distances, and then a lot of people consider the 5,000 as well.
Right, and steeplechase being 3K.
3K, correct, yep. Yeah.
All right, so... as you developed as a coach, what are some of the things that you saw change in terms of your fundamentals over the years in the way that you approach people?
In the way that I approach athletes or
mm-hmm.
approach
yeah.
people?
Yeah.
I think...
Sorry.
No worries. I think with athletes, when I started off coaching, I had a really good mentor coach who was Ilana Meyer's first coach, the gal that ended up winning silver in the 10,000, setting the world half marathon record. But he shoved me in to teach straight away. I said, I need to know about tapering. I need to know about training programs. And the first thing he did is he said, I've got a lecture tomorrow on training theory. You giving it. You know, it's like my very first year in coaching. But I think, like most coaches, I start off saying there must be some magic training program. If I could just learn, and I studied Lydiard, and a very strong influence on me was Pat Cloese, the Australian coach who coached Rob Di Castella. And I'd, you know, been reading a lot about Viren and John Walker and those class of athletes. And I really thought it was about training programs. And pretty soon I realized, okay, it's probably, you know, a mixture of the training and then the type of person, you know, the type of personality that the athlete is, and started taking an interest in the motivational side of things. And then much, much later, even though I have some qualifications in mechanics, I started realizing, wow, on the physical side, I haven't done a thing about mechanics. And I started to take a real big interest in mechanics about probably 12 years ago. And put those three together, and then I just sort of defined it for myself how I will coach from now on from a physical standpoint, is distinguish between peripheral coaching, you know, coaching the peripherals of the athlete, coaching the central system of the athlete, and then coaching the mechanics.
Okay, and so put that in really simple terms when you say peripheral, central, and the mechanics.
Well, you know, pretty soon I started coaching older athletes, mm-hmm. and realizing that there was not much I could do for them from a cardiovascular standpoint. If you know, their cardiovascular system had high integrity, you know, the resting heart rate was coming down and they were showing all those and their bloods were good, I realized the most changes I could make would be with the peripherals, which is the leg muscles themselves, you know, starting to go for those changes. And, you know, Tim Noakes and those intelligent folks had figured it out that peripherally there's, you know, there's a lot more you can do as the athlete gets older than you can do centrally.
And as far as training triathlete running or triathlon running and pure running, what do you see as some of the fundamental differences in bringing about people's ability to do it at their best in terms of running off the bike and running open running races?
Yeah. Well, Gordon and I have discussed this quite a lot, but to me, there's really no difference between regular running and running off the bike per se. But in terms of what the triathlete has to deal with prior to the run, you know, so you're dealing with a great reduction in energy resources, great reduction, great increase in fatigue. You're also dealing with an athlete that's generally larger because of the swimming and the cycling. So, you know, you're dealing with an athlete with a almost a mechanically suppressed VO2 max just because they have to have bigger upper bodies. The other thing too is that triathletes don't develop naturally as runners because the form fits function issue doesn't work. In other words, they don't run enough to become runners. They've got too much biking and too much swimming to do. And then the big myth that you should, you know, if you're injured with running, which triathletes are generally much more injured as runners than they are injured as cyclists or swimmers, they rehab on the bike and they just exacerbate the problem. So dealing with a heavier athlete and athletes that are not developing naturally as a runner because there's too little time to run and there's too little incidence of running for them to truly adapt. And then their backgrounds. And you know, in the US, we have a very strong swimming nation. And so a lot of athletes are sourced from swimming. And swimming creates a whole host of problems that really hurt the distance runner from a mechanic standpoint.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. In the mechanic standpoint, swimmers tend to have their pelvis tilted slightly forward. And so when they stand up, they have this arched low back and this high chest carry. And they don't create a lot of natural momentum when they run. So that's one of the things. If they do the symmetrical strokes like butterfly and especially breaststroke, they have weaker ligaments, or not necessarily weaker ligaments, but laxer ligaments on the inside of their knees. And so they have sort of swimming created Q angles, you know, that the girls bring to the running sport. So they have knee instability. The other thing is the athlete, swimmers have a high degree of plantar flexion. And they have very, very little dorsiflexion. And it's exactly the opposite in running. You need a ton of dorsiflexion and very little plantar flexion. Well, you don't need little plantar flexion, but you need a lot of dorsiflexion. And they don't have it. You know, if you look at an athlete like Sarah Haskins, that's one of the things I've been working on a lot, is trying to get her to get the soleus more flexible, because she's such a fine swimmer and comes from a swimming background. And then from a mental standpoint I talk about swimmers as having black line fever. You know, they can swim, you know, 50, 60, 100, 120 kilometers a week, mm-hmm. you know, and they bring that mentality to running and they break down instantly. And because of the suspended environment that they're in, their bone density is not great either, you know, and they need really good bone density as runners. So they don't have the patience to build into running. You know, there's a saying out there that says, as an adult without injuries, uninterrupted 4 years of training before you begin to discover how good a runner you can be. Mm-hmm. And a swimmer doesn't want to wait.
It's so true.
Mm-hmm.
not just swimmers, I think triathletes as well. I mean, just to hear you say 4 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was walking for years before I ever started to run. I started by trying to run, but I just fell apart, like you said, instantly, first run. And it's just refreshing to hear sort of that 4 year time horizon for people to bear in mind.
If you have any sort of swimming form, you can get in the pool and straight away get some sort of a cardiovascular workout. To get a real cardiovascular workout out of a run, as a beginner, it's just not doable. You will break down mechanically way before you get there. And, you know, that's why even hearing it from Gordo, listening to him saying, you know, you might need to consider if you're becoming an Ironman athlete of doing a year plus of base work before you really start training as a runner. And I absolutely believe that, you know, another truism that of Gordo's that I like to tout all the time is the concept of there's no such thing as a recovery run for most triathletes. Mm-hmm. They just are not efficient enough, light enough, or have run enough to get recovery benefits from a run. 15 minutes, 20 minute run is hard work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas a 15, 20 minute spin on the bike is ludicrous.
Earlier when you were talking a bit about not running enough and injuries that come about, cycling, rehab, and that sort of thing. So I'd like to ask, what do you think that cycling does that contributes to running problems, injuries, that sort of thing within the triathlete?
Bad question, because do we have the time? Well, you know, back in South Africa in the early days in apartheid, we used to invent these stupid competitions because we weren't allowed to participate internationally. And one of the things that we did was is we brought all the national class sportsmen together for a 3-day. It was sponsored by a company called Super C that made vitamin C candies. And we had the swimmers and the cyclists and the cricketers and the rugby players, and they all competed against each other. And they did crunches and 400 meters and 1500 meters and things like that. And throughout, the cyclists sucked at everything. They absolutely sucked at everything.
We're going to have to get a roadie on here to defend himself.
Do they run into the same bone density issue that swimmers do?
No, I don't. I haven't discovered that. You know, and again, when you get a cyclist, there is considerable pressure. So I don't think they have the same bone density issues, and I'm talking completely anecdotally here. So the two things to me with cycling from a sheer mechanic standpoint is this very, very shut hip angle, which is even more pronounced with the triathlete, especially the Ironman triathlete, because they spend so much time with this hip angle totally shut between the belly and the thigh. You know, and I've worked with some runners. I think Mark will forgive me if I talk about him because he's not really a runner, Mark van Akeren. So a fantastic swimmer, you know, the best swimmer in Ironman probably, and a very, very adequate biker, but he puts himself in such an aero position on the bike that with poor mechanics to start with, when he tries to run, his hip flexors and things just like can't handle the movement at all. They're so shortened, you know. Then the other thing is depending.
That's an interesting point, because you look at some of the positions of some of the fastest runners in triathlon, and it's not shut.
No.
It's not shut at all.
No,
I mean, you know, we've got Greg Bennett on in 2 weeks, and he's one of the fastest guys, non-drafted.
Yeah.
And he rides very open.
Very upright.
And you look at some of the positions on the Ironman scene as well, some of the men that are able to run very fast, quite open. And there's a big cost in aerodynamics of doing that.
Well, you know, if you talk to people like Dean Golich, who I really, really respect in terms of cycling, he says, you know, aero takes precedence in cycling completely over anything else, fatigue, losing a little bit of wattage and things like that. But in triathlon, I completely and utterly disagree. You know, you can lose, you know, aggressively, probably from a really bad aero position on the bike, you could probably lose 10 minutes in Ironman. But from being so shut, you don't lose 10 minutes on the run, you lose 20, 30 minutes from sitting down at the side of the road, from not moving at all, from, you know, being unable to actually run.
Is the concept of being closed off, does that address the race itself in the sense that you're riding really aerially for 4.5, 5 hours, or is it training in that position and
both.
What it does to you?
Both. Absolutely both, but probably much, much more training. Probably much, much more training. We know from very strong anecdotal evidence that, you know, the grinders on the bike, the people with the low cadence tend to be the low cadence runners, and the low cadence runners are always the poorer runner. So you can imagine from...
One famous exception from your mm-hmm. country.
Yeah.
Simon Lessing.
Oh, okay.
And if you look at his body type, yeah. his cadence sort of fits his body type. But he wasn't... We'll get him on eventually.
On the bike, his cadence fits his body type, or on the run, his stride rate fits his body type?
We'll have him on. We'll ask him. But mm-hmm. generally, when I've seen him, he is not sort of like a high cadence athlete. He's more, there's almost a little bit, I don't know, loping's an mm-hmm. exaggeration, mm-hmm. but he's someone who's extremely, obviously very fit, very yeah. talented.
Very strong.
Do you think that the cadences within cycling to running have to be within the same parameters, or can there be a separation, meaning I ride at 80, run at 90?
No, I think some people can do it, and it's a question of, you know, cognitively learning to turn up the cadence if you're a slow biker. But I think essentially with the studies that have been done with athletes like Lance Armstrong, that when left to their own devices, once again, form fits function, and cyclists will always, as the volume increases, will creep to higher cadences. And I don't think Simon is so much an exception. I think Simon, you know, when he has perfect conditions like that wonderful race that he had at Lake Placid, can get away with it. That's one of my contentions, that as soon as it's hot, as soon as it's windy, as soon as it's hilly, as soon as it was a particularly brutal bike ride, a particularly competitive bike ride, the runners with the slow cadence will always drop out. And you know, it's again, you know, you look at Simon and you say some races he's done really, really well, and other races he hasn't done that well, and in fact has dropped out. And I think that, you know, some of Simon's harder losses, for example, like when he lost the world championships to Dimitri Gog, who's now just been banned for drug use in Tisha Vivaros, and that's why he didn't compete in the Olympics. If you look at the footage of that final straightaway, you see Gog much more linear, much quicker turnover, and able to get away from Simon, you know. And again, when you looked at the Olympics, it's exactly the same thing. We all knew that if there was 1500 meters to go and Javier Gomez had not shaken off the rest of the pack, he was going to lose because of poorer mechanics. He's unable to sprint. He's unable to change that power running of his, which brings him a 29-30 off the bike sometimes. But he's unable to change gears. And mm-hmm. so he always gets beaten when somebody stays with him. So, I digress a little bit. But I think with somebody like Simon, he overcomes through brute force, and I think that's what happens. I mean, you know, people like, even like Gabriel Selassie, they've worked a little bit with his mechanics because he tends to be a little chest high, and couldn't do it. Didn't work, you know. And you look at Paula, you know, where the rubber meets the road, she's fantastic, but she's not as linear as she could be. There's a lot of rotational forces, there's a lot of downward forces, and so on. So they'll get better.
And talking about some mm-hmm. of the lackings of these athletes who are world class. Mm-hmm. So not to say that you can't be world class and not be able to improve. So what is good running form? I mean, if you were to break it down, maybe to let's start with three key elements.
Mm-hmm.
What might they be? What are we looking for?
Well, let me just finish up on that cycling thing. You know, you asked me. I think the vastus lateralis from this the soma types of athletes that tend to be muscular get too big, so they get these very heavy, heavy legs.
Which is the outside muscle of
the quadricep. The outside muscle of the quadricep, yeah.
Never been a problem of mine.
Yeah. Gordo's got giant legs.
Monster!
And then the other part of it is cyclists that have a lot of ankling going on, that have that kind of body type, that develops musculature, develop the big gastrocnemius muscle, the big calf muscle, the high calf muscle. It's too heavy. And those athletes that tend to have a real problem with turnover. And then the last one is the pedal. The pedal type, especially the athletes with the bigger feet, they set themselves up for all sorts of problems.
If they're rocking.
They're rocking this, you know, that kind of small speed play type pedal where they fall off the outside or they fall off the inside. Or they drop their heels dramatically.
Do you know what sort of pedal Sam McGlone's on?
Yep.
Is she on Speedplay?
Not anymore. I think she's on Shimano pedals.
Okay.
I think so.
Because
yeah.
as soon as a triathlete has Achilles issues, yeah. you know, I read that she's not going to
yeah.
Hawaii.
Yeah.
I always say, look at the bike setup.
Yeah.
It might have, you know, because 9 times out of mm-hmm. 10, maybe 95 out of 100,
yeah.
it's got something to do with exactly that. Pedal interface, if there's any rocking there, because there's so many repetitions, the calf gets overloaded and then it goes into the Achilles.
And again, you take that one step further, it doesn't show up on the bike. It shows up on the run.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so the athlete thinks it's the run, but it's not the run, it's the bike.
Yeah.
I know Slam very well. I work quite a lot with Sam, and she's been very gracious in acknowledging certain of her victories to having me on her shoulder. And I haven't actually spoken to her so much about the pedal interface, because her husband Cliff coaches her, and he's a very, very good cycling coach. But it's definitely something I will bring up with her. But she's had that niggle for a long time and been able to hold it at bay, but it's worth asking. So let's get back to your question. Sorry.
Run form. Three elements to start with. Three key elements.
You know, this past weekend we had the big art and science festival with triathlon, and I ended up on stage with Nicholas Romanov, and we spoke about the pose method, and he spoke about the pose method. I spoke about my approach rather than a methodology. And I think I don't really have a method. I take each athlete individually and change that. But if I had to talk about three key elements, it would probably be the two elements that create cadence. So I'd say primary A number one is turnover, stride rate. Mm-hmm. And then I'd say the two issues that create that stride rate, the two components that create that stride rate is, one is the lean, and two is the fact that you push from your knee up position till you contact the ground, which is the diametrically opposed to what Nicholas is saying, you know. So I'd say those are the three components.
Knee up, you got to explain that to me.
So in other words, a lot of people, when you're trying to teach them to drive, they think driving is from foot contact until your foot leaves the ground.
Okay.
Whereas driving is from the time that your knee reaches its highest point in the front till your foot hits the ground. Then it's over. There's no drive beyond that phase. Otherwise, you start engaging all sorts of muscles and you start over-rotating and you start hurting yourself. But it's just that push down. In fact, there's now slowly but surely a school of thought starting to rise. It's extremely difficult to study, and I haven't even tried to put forward a proposition of how a study like that would look. Gordon and I have talked about maybe doing work with a runner and measuring purely their economy. You know, how much oxygen are they using at a certain speed? Work with their mechanics, put them back on the treadmill at the same speed. If they're using less oxygen, we're winning. But there's definitely a strong school of thought now that says you load this whole spring, the hip joint, the knee joint, and the ankle joint, by driving your foot very powerfully straight down. And when you hit the ground, then everything starts to load. With the forward lean and with gravity, it's like a pogo stick being thrown into the ground at an angle. It's now loaded, and now you let go, and it unloads. And that's why I disagree with the fact that there's any hamstring contraction going on. It's all centrifugal. When the heel gets to the butt, then the hamstring engages just to keep it there and then decelerates the forefoot out the front. So, you know, raising your hamstring up at the back is, to me, is about as much myth as the fact that you should pedal in circles and not just push down. Because that's also now come to the fore, that the top cyclists in the world push. End of story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had a few people email me various questions, most of which were in lines with what Gordo and I had already come up with.
Okay.
But one person kind of wrote in and said, do you take the analogy of someone like Tiger Woods, who recently changed his stroke?
Mm-hmm.
All right. He was on top, but knew that he could get better.
Mm-hmm.
And during the time that he changed it, he had to go through an adaptation period and ultimately came out winning.
Mm-hmm.
So his basic question was, along those same lines, how can someone with the limitations that they have biomechanically break it back down to the basics and then start to build in good run form?
It's a wonderful question, and it's something that I think that people should take on a lot more. First of all, in running, just like cycling and swimming, you need a minimum range of flexibility. You don't need a maximum range of flexibility. You're not a gymnast or something like that. So it's very seldom, you know, when I'm teaching biomechanics, I'll say to people is you're trying to see if certain problems are created functionally. In other words, it can be changed. It's musculature. It's through bad habituation. Or their mechanics are poor because of structural issues, because of skeletal issues. And very, very few runners have skeletal issues that are completely limiting to some kind of good running form. Now, obviously, it's governed by speed, but in our sport, you know, you've got to think that the fastest runner off the bike, Javier Gomez, for 10K, and, you know, people that are running low 240s or high 230s off the bike, in Ironman, have good enough mechanics, but you can still, you know, pick their form apart. But they're still not running at their maximum speed. So Javier could possibly run maybe 28:50, 28:45. I don't know. I mean, somebody like Mark Allen, I think, was a 2:16 marathoner. And I think he could have gone fast. I think in the trials he ran 2:22 or something like that. So if you take the 2:22 and you extrapolate that to, you know, a 2:39 or a 2:40 off the bike, you can see that they're not going as fast as they can possibly go. So triathlon really lends itself to working on mechanics and saying, taking away things from the athlete that are limiting their run performance, as opposed to saying, you know, you just don't have the ability to do that. You know, often I'll work with somebody who comes from a swimming background. You know, the studies have shown very interesting, swimmers are bigger, you know, maybe because they develop a little subcutaneous layer and they carry a bit more fat tissue. But mostly they tend to be a little heavier and carry a little higher percentage of body fat because they can train so hard that when they finish training, they sit around to eat bonbons. Because they, you know, like runners can still go out and walk and they can go out and do things, and triathletes as well. So I really, really believe you can change those mechanics. And I think there is a runner actually who just did that. I think it was Lydia Simon. She was, you know, she ran 2:22 round about there, and she did a lot of marathons, a lot of road races, was making a good living at it, but she kind of drifted out to 2:26, 2:27, and then came back, said, I want to run 10,000. I want to relearn my mechanics. I want to go back to having the mechanics of a 10,000 meter runner. And her, you know, even at, I mean, she must be 39, 40, somewhere in there. She's now starting to improve again in the marathon. So as an overriding answer, absolutely everybody can change their mechanics. You know, there's some people who have shallow acetabulums, you know, and they're going to have a little bit of external.
You gotta tell us what that is.
Okay. Shallow hip joints. And so their feet are externally rotated. So they're a little bit of duck footed.
Right.
And no matter how much they strengthen their glute medius and glute minimus muscles, their feet aren't going to come in.
Okay.
They're going to be out like that. In fact, even when I was at school, I used to look on the playing field and look at the guys that were pigeon-toed, and I could guess that they were the fastest runners.
Right.
Because centrifugally, their feet would come out straight when they sprinted, right. You know, whereas ours start off here, you know, slightly open and then open even further. But those things can, you know, most of those things can be altered. So muscle lengths can be altered, you know, spinal sets can be altered, the position of the chest can be altered, all those things you can address, you know, muscle tonus and muscle weaknesses. And a lot of my work is about core. And a lot of runners run poorly simply because they don't have a specifically trained core muscles, you know. And those aren't difficult things to change. Some of them take a little bit of time.
Probably the biggest thing that I feel that I learned from you is that it's, a couple things. I mean, in running terms, most of the runners in triathlon are not particularly, they're not going all that fast. I'm gonna have to get the phone.
So they're not particularly fast. I don't know where he was going with that.
why don't we wait for him to come back, and then we just address something, you know, within those lines. I think
okay, we'll do.
I like to consider run mechanics more like chiropractic than like PT. So whereas a guy like Nicholas Romanov with the pose method, he will say it can take years sometimes to get people to run the right way. But I have way too many testimonials of people that say, I came to see you last week. 3 days before I came to see you, I went on my regular 90-minute run. This was my steady state heart rate during that run. And 3 days afterwards, I ate the same thing at the same time of day. I ran the same route. I ran 3 minutes faster. My cruising heart rate was 4 beats lower. The temperature was the same, like that, you know. So, yeah, some people who have muscle weakness and things like that, you can take a long time to change, yeah.
My experience is, you know, when we work together, mm-hmm. Providing I do what you recommend, mm-hmm. that's the toughest part, yeah. is breaking the habit.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can just go out and do that, break the habit, better right away.
Absolutely, and that's the way it should be. Everything should be better. You know, Joe Friel once asked me, Joe said we were at the Olympic trials in Hawaii for the 2004 Olympics, and he said to me, why are you still working with people's mechanics? The trials are tomorrow. And he said, you know, isn't that against all, you know, perceptual motor teaching? And I said, were you at the pool this morning? He said, yeah. And I said, were people working with form and hand entries and things? He said, yeah, that's what they do. And I said, well, why would they change it on the pool? You know, we had the same question with biking, with what's her name? Carol from South Africa, very good cycling coach. Carol Austin from South Africa, she's a top cycling coach there, coaches the African time trial champion and so on. And we had kids a week before the World Championships, and we were working, she was measuring their bike fit. And, you know, changing their bike saddle position 3 or 4 millimeters when they were already complaining about a knee issue or a low back issue or something like that. The week before the championships, they felt much better. It showed up on the computer trainer. So, you know, there are things that take a long time to change. But as Gordo says, even though you don't want to have cognitive intervention, I don't coach mechanics like that. I don't tell people every single step I want you to think of doing this. No, I change set points. I just want you to do this and keep it there. And then everything else will fall into place. So we can get back to Gordo's question now.
Yeah, except we moved on. Okay. I think I forgot. What was I chatting about?
That triathletes in themselves are not running that fast or that quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I've had some success running. But in running terms, I'm not particularly fast. I'm not particularly biomechanically sound. I mean, I'm okay. I can do a fair amount of volume. I think for the person that sent in that question saying, you know, look, is it worth the change? Can I go through the change? Well, absolutely. I mean, it's not as complicated as learning how to swim or something. No. I mean, you know, the nice thing about when I work with Bobby, it's, again, he talks about reset points. There's, you know, he takes a look at you. There's just a couple things to work on.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that in triathlon, and I don't really know why, but you know, there's always in my opinion, an overemphasis of form in the water and an underemphasis of form in the two other sports. In terms of, you know, cycling and running, they might be like, this is all about conditioning, and swimming is all about your technique.
Mm.
And, you know, don't swim hard, swim better, you know, but run hard, cycle hard, and it'll all work out.
Yeah.
And so I think, but you know, I think they really need to all be approached in the same manner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to get better, you need to do everything better.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, there's thousands of things racing through my mind right now. And one of them is that when we were at the Olympics, the thing that blew me away was when you finally got an entire team of experts together, they were always going to be better than the individual. So I had a situation where one of the athletes called me up to the track. He had to do a 5-mile time trial. And I've not worked with this athlete's mechanics before in depth at all. We hadn't worked at all. Excuse me. And I wrote down a bunch of things. And as luck would have it, the athlete was warming down, and I walked back down to the training center where we were with the training camp before the Olympics. And I went to see the chiropractor. And this athlete was going to see the chiropractor after this run session. And I said, listen, this is what I saw. And I gave him about 9 or 10 points. Athlete came in. I wasn't there. He came to me. He said, when the athlete came in, he said, don't say a word. Just get on the plinth. And he went down my list of things. And one of the things, for example, that I said was, as I said, something going on with his right soleus because he's not putting his heel down at all. But he is putting it down on the left foot. And he went in there, and the minute he touched it, the athlete went through the roof. And every single one of those points, he went there, he said, how does this feel? And the athlete said, it feels terrible. And, you know, that's how mechanics can be. So, you know, during our travels, I've met so many people that I said, you know, if we could have these 5 individuals, plus a head coach, working on this athlete's performance would go through the roof. And so I think, you know, changing somebody's mechanics is an absolute must. The only reason I think we don't mess with it is because it's a first language activity. We don't remember learning to run. We were never taught how to run. I remember touring Europe in 86 and watching people do drills at track and field clubs, regular athletes, the discus throwers, the javelin throwers, the pole vaulters, the high jumpers, the sprinters, the distance runners. They were all doing the same drill session, And the coach was basically teaching them how to run. And we don't do that in our paradigm, you know. Mm-hmm. We get taught how to swim, over-taught perhaps mm-hmm. how to swim, you know. The sport is full of athletes that swim not quite mechanically perfect, and they do just fine. But we need to teach athletes how to run. And especially, you know, if you look at the Olympic model again and you look at the triathletes, and you'll see the U.S. triathletes are large. They're bigger than the mm-hmm. average triathlete,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so we have to pay even more attention to mechanics while this model exists of us drawing from a swimming background, mm-hmm. you know. You look at somebody like Emma or Loretta Harrop or something, they are absolutely minute, and they actually built like slightly large distance wow. runners.
Laura's a friend of mine. She's yeah. about the same size as Paula Radcliffe.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, but Laura is exceptional in as much as...
She was also the closest to a medal that the U.S. had.
Correct.
Exactly. from a running perspective, right. Yeah.
One thing, just before we move on, just when you talk about putting that team together
mm-hmm.
for the elite athletes,
mm-hmm.
I think the athletes that understand that and have the financial resources, mm-hmm. they do that already. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If we look at other people, I mean, you know, Dara Torres, Lance Armstrong, mm-hmm. The athletes that are at the top
mm-hmm.
and where it really matters if they get it done or mm-hmm. not, and then they have access to capital, they build that around themselves. I mean, it's something that I did as well for myself, bringing in you mm-hmm. sort of as a specific run coach, bringing in you know, access to massage and various mm-hmm. things. You build your own team around yep, yourself. Yep. I think a lot of people in triathlon, particularly some of the fastest amateur athletes do that, some of the smarter ones. They mm-hmm. build these little teams mm-hmm. around themselves, mm-hmm. Training partners even as well.
You know, I tell the story sometimes. I say, you know, I ran high 34s for 10K, and I ran around about 36 minutes on my very best day off the bike. And I said to people, you know, if I had a massage once a week, if I stopped playing golf, if I spent no time with my family... I had my back sorted out once a week by a chiropractor or a PT or something like that, I might run 33 high, but in the grand scheme of things, what's that going to bring me, you know?
Yeah.
So some people really want to find out how good can they be. And I really suggest that they go that way. If they yeah. have the resources and that kind of thing, I really think they can do that. But I think we're also sitting around here talking that there must be intermediate ways where people can be encouraged. I mean, you get, you know, engineers and doctors and people that come to the sport and they make the most ludicrous errors, both nutritionally, logistically, strategically, training wise. They pick up pieces of arbitrary information that they throw together in a pot and they just ruin themselves. And, you know, with that kind of ability that they have intellectually, you think that they should be able to put together something where they can view themselves objectively and say, wow, you know, this is stupid. I could do this a lot better by doing this, that, and the other, you know. Anyway.
So I'm taking a little away from the biomechanics, and I'd like to know how you gauge intensity for your athletes. How do you prescribe your training zones for your athletes?
You know, I go from one end to the other. I used to be, when the heart rate monitors first came out, I was one of the first people in South Africa to get, before they were even called Polar, I used to get the heart rate monitors from Sweden. And if I tested them and gave them feedback, they'd give me the monitor. And so this was a long time ago. I can't even remember when it was, but they were the first ones, the big clunky things.
Yeah. Remember Mark them? Talks, yeah. Well, no, this is before me, but Mark talks about having this box on his chest.
Yep.
When he first started it.
Yep. Yeah. You also used to get a little box on your back, which when we first tested it, 2.8 pounds, I think, weight or something like that. Anyway, but you know, subsequently, I found that heart rate is so variable, and there are so many ways that heart rate gets influenced. So I would use it as a background marker of what I'm doing. Funnily enough, I find it best when you're doing specific intensity workouts. If the athlete can run the velocity, can run the speed, but they can't get the heart rate, then I also know it's not, you know, it's not a good time to do that workout. So I would say the bottom line to me is, if the variables of surface and terrain and weather are contained, then I say the only way to go is velocity. You know, we don't have a watt meter on a running shoe. I wish we did, but basically effort. I would, you know, have people correlate effort. Hunter Kemp is famous for following that guideline. George Dalham coached him, and he'll go into the lab and he would do RPE scales during his warm-up. And if he was 1 or 2 points higher on the RPE scale on his warm-up at previous intensities, he wouldn't do, you know, the hyperoxic, the supplemental oxygen workout at all. But, you know, it definitely is, has to be gauged in some ways subjectively and some ways objectively. So
if we come to the objective test, so for a triathlete, what do you think is a really good benchmark for a test? I mean, what's the sort of number that we need to know?
Okay. I really like, I call it an efficiency test. 2,400 meters or 2.4 Ks or a mile and a half. Warm up extremely well. And then run around and just arbitrarily measure 80% of heart rate reserve. All right, so in other words, use the resting heart rate as an evening factor. And
so again, heart rate reserve would be max minus resting.
Yeah, multiplied by the factor.
Times by 80.
Yeah, in this particular case, 80, yeah.
So
Plus the resting heart rate.
So just to do numbers for people that are listening. So let's say my max is 200, my resting is 40. So that's 160.
Yeah.
Right. Multiplied 80% of that is going to be 128?
60, isn't it?
80% of 160.
Gordo's displaying a skill that I didn't know he had.
128 plus 40 is going to be 168.
Yeah, so 168. Okay. So the athlete warms up and then proceeds to do a series of strides and short little tempo runs, 25, 30-second tempo runs, gradually bringing his heart rate up until it's right there.
Just hits it.
Just hits it. As soon as he hits it, he starts the test straight away.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Then runs the 6 laps on the track.
Yeah.
All right. And track being best. Runs the 6 laps on the track, keeping that heart rate at least within 5 beats on either side, but preferably 3 beats on either side.
Mm-hmm.
And looks at his speed. And then 6 weeks later does it again, 6 weeks later does it again. And I've done this with countless marathon groups, where I measure this at the beginning of their base phase. And you know, some of these base phases can be 4 weeks long, and some of them can be as long as you know, 20 weeks of base work. And I do a test in the middle as well. And even with very experienced runners that have been running, you know, 2 marathons a year or a marathon a year after 4 or 5 years, they still display this dramatically, statistically significant drop in speed, the increase in speed at the same heart rate over the course of that training. And it's a wonderfully motivating tool, but it also shows the number up straight away. And then the other one is just a set of something. 5,000s with the same recovery at the same velocity, and see what happens to heart rate at the beginning and what happens to heart rate at the end.
I just punched my numbers in. That's not far off a kind of a max aerobic or a marathon type thing. Little bit higher for me.
Yeah.
In terms of where I'd be at, but it's
similar to what Friel does. Friel's is slightly higher than Maffetone as well, so it'd probably be more along this.
Okay.
Because 168 would probably work for me as that.
Right. So we would. So in that case, that's going to be what we're looking at: how that pace is moving over time.
Yes.
To get a feel for, is it working?
Yeah.
Is the plan working? Okay.
And if you look back at the history of the great runners, whether it's Seb Coe or Peter Elliott or Steve Cram or, oh dear.
Bobby just beeped. It's not me. I turned my phone off. Mars is coming in to rescue him.
Save me. Save me. Yeah. I got it shut. I forgot I had it. And they all have a test set.
Yeah.
They all have a favorite set that tells them. And
yeah, I got my own test set too.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Jim Ryan. You know where you're at. Yeah, exactly. Jim Ryan was at this seminar that I attended recently. And that was the question I asked him. I said, how did you know you were ready? And he had 2 favorite test sets, and the one was fascinating, actually. The one was a 10-mile relay. And in those days, what they used to do is they used to run, 2 guys used to run 10 miles on the track in alternating 400s. So you'd rest as much as the other guy took to run the 400.
Yeah.
And then you'd send your results to other universities around the country, and they'd also do them, and you'd compete against each other like that. And it was a fantastic workout. And he said he would, for 3 days afterwards, he would do nothing. He'd be so, so shattered, you know, because, you know, you're running, you know.
20 quarters.
Yeah, exactly. 40, you know, 40 quarters between the two of them. And then his other one was a set of 200s, but it's arbitrary. But there is a test set that you can do on your bike, that you can do in the pool, that you do, you know, that works very, very well. But nailing down as many parameters as you can, and then just doing a run like that is a very good indicator.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. New topic?
I wanted to
change gears. What do you got?
Well, I just wanted to ask a little bit about the run-walk protocol that he has.
Yeah.
Because I think that's unique, and I don't think people totally get it or how to apply it. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk about why you think it's important, how people can use it in their own training.
Just before, just a little bit of personal information on that. I've done a 115 off the bike twice using run walk.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily, you know, doesn't. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think they're giving away a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think I gain time with it. So overall.
You know, again, and I've spoken to Gordo about this, and we've spoken as well. We've got to do the study, but you know, with this periodized nutrition and the clarity of us being trying to move that crossover point of fat burning to as far to the right as we possibly can, you know, from that heavily scientific standpoint, the walk run is going to prove itself beyond a doubt as to be the way to go as fast as possible in Ironman off the bike. Now, there's a myth that exists, and there's even training programs all over the country for 10Ks all the way up to the marathon. And they called run the whole way training plans or run the whole way schedules. And this just propagates this myth that somehow you are an inferior human being if you walk in a distance running event, you know. And, you know, just like the same thing is are our shoes too supportive, you know, or should we be trending towards barefoot? It's exactly the same thing. The run walk method from the very beginner who can now suddenly complete a 10K safely in a time way faster than that individual would have done if they'd run the whole way, all right? And also probably would have done themselves an injury, all right? Right up to the elite of Gordo talking about a very, very, very respectable run time off the bike of 1 hour 15 for a half marathon after a 56-mile bike. Clearly shows that this walk run method works. And what people need to remember, you know, even at its extreme, which is 10 minutes of running and 1 minute of walking, you are propelling yourself forward while you walk. You're also trying to maintain a cadence or a stride rate that is only about, you know, 30 steps at the most less than your running cadence. You're keeping your same arm carriage, everything like that. So you're not sauntering along, you're really walking. So most people who get proficient at this can do like a 12 or a 13-minute mile, all right? And so you're trying to do 6-minute miles, and 1/11th of that 10-minute period, you're doing it at 13-minute mile pace, all right? But if you follow the statistics, you know, proven in marathons, longer events, is that most people tend to start too fast, and then they seem to settle onto the pace that they want for maybe 5 miles in the marathon, 5 or 6 miles in the marathon. Then they start to gradually decline to, you know, Ironman, it's 15, 16 miles. In a marathon, it's 18 to 20 miles. And then there's dramatic drop-off of pace. So even if your overall pace is even slightly slower, which it generally isn't, than what you would do if you were running the whole way, the amount that you make up in that last 8 miles is obscene.
Because, it's, you know, huge. Yeah. It's massive.
Mentally as well as physically, yeah.
That's part of it too. I mean, you can have all the physiological and metabolic arguments, but the fact is, if you're not falling apart when everybody around you is having trouble, you're going to be able to dig deeper and you're going to be able to finish quicker.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's where it really comes. I mean, because when I did Vine Man, this, you know, I had to work really hard to catch this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And we were about 12K in. And then I just let him go. And I did a little bit of a walk break.
Mm-hmm.
Had 4 glasses of cola.
Yeah.
And I was back. It only took me 500 meters to catch back up to him.
Yeah.
And it wasn't hard. And then I just went right by the guy. And because you've just, you get that reset, like you were saying, you got the calories coming in, you just don't fall apart at the end.
you know, your heart rate goes down, you absorb fluid better, you absorb calories better. The other thing too is your mindset says, I never have to run further than 10 minutes. I've just got to run 10 minutes, then I'm getting a break again. I've got a little thing I call the Zard formula, where I guide a marathon runner to go 10 minutes, walk 30 seconds, the first third of the race.
Yeah.
10 minutes, walk 45 seconds, the second third, and 10 minutes, walk a minute, the last third. And time again, people negative split with that. So they're walking more at the end, but they're running faster.
Yeah.
You know, so not only are you thinking, let's say you want to run a 7 minute mile, you're not only trying to do the calculation of that 7 minute mile pace for that 10 minutes, how much faster should I be running to negate the degrading effect of the one minute walk. But the fact is, it's so much easier to run faster that people end up running faster than they need to make up for the loss. So not only are they ending up not losing that huge drop off at the end, they're actually running faster overall because they can, in 10-minute chunks, run faster than they need to even accommodate the one-minute walk.
Yeah.
So it makes so much sense. And then
I think when you look at a number of people, if we just take it back to Ironman, mm-hmm. People that have really struggled just to say get under 4 hours, mm-hmm. This is something they can do that will instantly make that mm-hmm. difference because they'll be able to mentally reset, get their calories. And I think it's sort of the middle of the field, those people that are sort of in that 4 to 4.5 hour type range. The reason it's taking them that long, a number of those athletes, is because halfway through the run, they just fall apart for miles and they give away a lot of time. And if they go in with a strategy that'll let them keep moving, it works great. It's one of the best things I've learned from you.
One of the very first times I tried this, I did it with a Leadville athlete, and she came to me, reasonably successful ultra marathon runner, and she could not crack 29 hours in Leadville. She just, no matter what she did, and she did more training, and you know, she ate more effectively and so on and so forth. And I said to a gal, the first 10 minutes off the line, you will walk, you will let everybody go.
For 10 minutes,
let everybody go.
Yeah.
And then you never run more than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And every time you get a slope that you absolutely know you can walk this slope as effectively, if not better, than run it,
yeah,
you walk it.
Yeah.
And she took 2.5 hours off her previous best time.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
You know? Yeah. So, you know, that's the extreme. But, you know,
you're talking about, you know, 10% performance gain. I think most people could achieve that in Ironman. Just take your total minutes, knock 10% off it just by doing run walk on the same fitness. I mean, that, and then don't drill at the first 40K of the bike. If you can do those two things, I think it's big gains.
I completely agree. The mechanics, the one thing, and the walk run, the other thing, the sky's the limit. You know, if you look at it from a physiological standpoint and you theorize about what's happening, you know, most of you know the condition compartment syndrome, where you basically fill up a muscle with so much blood that the sheath itself around the muscle blocks off the access and the exiting of the blood in that muscle, and you can lose it, and it happens to the tib, the posterior tib, and then people get that compartment syndrome where they have to have the sheath slit and it's a temporary solution. But most of us get something like that going on in these longer races where our legs get thick, pumped up, they don't drain enough. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, where they put the stethoscope on the back of your knee and they check out the sound of that popliteal or popliteal artery, as you guys say in the US, exiting venous blood through there, and it shuts down and eventually goes quiet, and you know that the whole thing's just gurged with blood and it's basically starting to die. And with the walk run method, that doesn't happen, because now you're putting your heel down, you're putting your foot down, the entire musculature is relaxing, there's not that heavy loading phase, and your body's vascularity is increasing massively. So you should, with a walk run method, not only be able to do all the things we've spoken about, but you should be able to maintain a higher heart rate throughout the marathon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. With the walk run method.
Thank good. You. That was good.
Yeah. All right. Can we do a question about Africa?
Yeah. I'd like to finish with that.
Oh, okay.
Because I think that's a very good question. The last real area that I'd like to address, because you wrote an entire book on it. Yeah. Sort of the psychology of an athlete. And I heard you speak about it at the USAT coaching clinic. And last night I was reading through the article that you have posted on your website, which is bobbymcgee.com, about the 99-1 grouping. And when I say that, I mean 90 is one number, 9 is one number, and 1 is one number.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that right now?
Randy Wilbur, who's the leading exercise physiologist for the USOC, and he does all the work with the endurance events, he's fond of yanking my chain and joking with me, saying, you know, if you don't have the numbers, I don't care how strong their heads are, they're not going to have the performance. And my retort to that is that, you know, and it's an arbitrary number, but if we did the stats, it would be very interesting. But 90% of athletes achieve more poorly in competition than they do in training. They don't fulfill the potential that they show in training. 9% of athletes are those athletes that are really, really easy to coach. They can do a test, and from that test, you can work out to a tenth of a second what they're going to be able to do. And I coach one athlete like that, and she'll go away, and I'll say, you know, average race, you should run 15-15 for 5K. And if you have if you put it all together and you keep it nice and solid, it'll be 15-10. But if you run out of your socks, you can break 15, you know, you can break 15 or something like that. And then she does that time and time again. And then you get the 1% of athletes. And I've worked with only 2 of them probably in my entire career. And the younger listeners won't remember this, but there was an athlete by the name of Zola Budd. And in fact, she's in the US at the moment, and she's living in South Carolina. And she's running 35-minute 10Ks as a 40-year-old now. But she was a 1%er. You know, she'd go down to the track, and I'd watch her, and she'd run on a grass track, and she'd run 6,000-meter repeats in, 2:55, you know, which is really good for a woman to run on the grass at sea level. But then on the weekend, she'd go and run 8:28 and break the world record for 3,000 meters, and the two do not equate at all. You know, so she never, ever once in her training showed, from a physical standpoint, what she was capable of in races. In races, she'd just step it up 8-10% and, you know, run out of a sock. So when I approach an athlete, it becomes a useful way to talk to that athlete, saying, do you agree with me, if you look at this and you look at your race results, that you're a 90%er, all right? And then open up the willingness for them to discuss what's going wrong, you know? Do we agree that the taper is good, you know, and this taper works for you? So when we do this kind of training and then we taper and we do a time trial, you bring this result. So it opens up for them to admit that, okay, wait a minute, my problem is not physical, it's not my training, it's not my taper, it's not my nutrition. It's in that other realm of the mental and the emotional and the spiritual. Similarly, with a 9%er, you can say to them, look, you're producing exactly the results that you show in training. So let's have a look at what is it that you're holding on to? How can we get you to step through the door, take a risk, you know, go a little bit beyond? You know, maybe reduce the training a little bit so that you feel you have a little bit of capacity, but how can we make you a 1%er? So that's how that came about. It's just a very useful tool.
And I mean, would you put psychology of an athlete as being at the forefront to performance in racing? Because you could have an athlete who might be able to handle whatever you throw at them training wise, and then they just fall apart on race day. Do you contribute that to something that happens within their training and they didn't do it right, or do you think it's more that they're being head cases?
I think every single case is different. I coached an athlete who had 2 separate world records on the road, and I always asked my athletes, you know, what were they thinking? How did they put that performance together mentally? And I remember her telling me that when she set the world record for the 20K, that she knew 5 steps in that it was going to be a grind. It was going to be tough and hard the whole damn day, you know? And she said she just, every single split, she just had to grind out, and it was unrelenting for her. And when she set the world record for 10 miles, she said she went up the first hill and she turned to say something to one of the runners and they were gone. They were 20 yards back. And she said, oh my goodness, it's going to be one of those days. This is like effortless, you know? And she just shut it off and she just ran as she felt, and she broke the world record, you know? So it's different with every athlete. Sometimes the first thing I ask as a coach is where did I make a mistake? Did I make a mistake? And we go through one thing and the other. And that's the beauty of following things like Gordo does. He keeps careful track of how he does things. And so you can always go back and say, all right, 5 days ago this happened, a month ago this happened, and you can make sure that you didn't make any mistakes from a physical standpoint. But very often, you know, the freak out performance is very easy to see. You know, the athlete's going along fine, everything's working fine. The athlete comes to a dead stop and bursts into tears or something like that. I've seen Gordo do that. No, I'm kidding.
That was a talk.
Yeah. And
wasn't a workout.
Yeah, no, that was wonderful. But and you know, with questionnaires and with working with an athlete for a long period of time, you get to know what their buttons are, you know. I've often worked with athletes that want it too much. You know, they're absolutely so attached to an outcome that the performance itself becomes greater than their entire life. And your job then is to point out to, well, what about the kitchen sink, you know? What about taking out the garbage? And then as a psychologist, my work very often centers around, if I'm working with an athlete with an obsessive compulsive disorder, something like anorexia or something like that, my job over a 3, 4, 5 year period is to slowly wean that athlete off the sport entirely. Say to them, look, you don't belong here. You're doing yourself a disservice here.
There's so much truth in that.
Yeah.
You're the only person in endurance athletics that has pointed that out to me.
Really?
Yeah. It's there's an amazing amount of insight there.
Well, it's very hard job to do. It's a very hard job to do.
Well, it's not, and I like the way you talk about it. It's not about telling somebody that. It's about working with them until they realize where it's at. I had an athlete that I worked with for actually only one season, but eventually, kind of with me a little bit, but also on her own, she came back years later and said, you know, some of the things you said, they make sense now. In other words, I was in it. I was in the middle of it. I couldn't see what was going on. And there's a lot of truth in there.
Don't know if you remember, I don't know if it was a TV show or what it was, but I learned it not from the show itself, but somebody explaining to me. There was this, these aliens invaded the Earth. And when the alien inhabited your body, it was on your head like this.
Yeah.
But you couldn't see it. If you had it yourself, you see? And it was a Stepford wife type thing. You know, you're trying to tell people, but the way we're doing this is great. And you say to them, you've got an alien in your face. No, I don't have an alien in my face. And it really is like that. It's like the layers of an onion, and working with an athlete to get to a point where they realize themselves, wow, the greatest gift I can give myself is to stop doing this to myself. You know, stop. And it's not easy, because you're right. They're right inside of it. And so when you phone them up and they've had another shocking performance, and then they're hurting and they're emotionally distraught, the first thing comes out of their mouth is, well, how can we fix this? Because I've 12 weeks, I'm racing here, you know? And that's not the opportunity to say, well, I don't think you should ever race again, you know?
Yeah, you got to stop, bro.
Anyway.
So if they want to read more about this sort of topic, what was the book that you wrote?
It's called Magical Running. And it's a workbook type thing where people can, especially for the people who like to quantify things, you know, it's a quantitative book where they can go through each of the specific mental skills, evaluate themselves and their skill level at that, and then takes them through how they can develop each one of those skills. And I found when I do formal sports psychology work, the nice thing is once you've done an evaluation, you're not spending your time talking to the converted. You find out what doesn't work and you retest them. You know, and then you work only in that area. And finally, with the kids of today, athletes under 35.
Kids today.
Is that their visualization skills are poor or not well developed. They have them very quickly. They pick them up very quickly. Because of videos and movies and stuff like that, they have lost the ability to imagine a performance, you know. Mm. I grew up, almost every single run I did, I ran with John Walker. I never met the man. But, you know, he was at my side, and I visualized every training session I did with John Walker. Occasionally, I'd throw Las Viren in there, and we'd have a run. But and kids don't
you
do
take
that.
Him? Yeah. Hey? You take Viren down?
You know, I never got Walker down, you know, because I think I admired him too much, but Viren I got all the time. I thought he was cheating. And
it's all that reindeer blood.
Yeah.
So the final question that we have is, What do you think that America can learn from Africa?
You know, when I looked at the question the first time, I thought, what can America learn from Africa? And I thought maybe what can the American endurance athlete learn from the African athlete? Because a lot of, you know, what's hard in Africa now is the scarcity mentality. And I think we can learn from a lot of the U.S. athletes in terms of having an abundance mentality. But in terms of the physical realities of what do the Africans do better? You know, Noakes did a very interesting study where he got the best white runners in South Africa and the best black runners in South Africa, and they let him do muscle biopsies, and they let him put them on, you know, test VO2 max and all this sort of thing. And so those things, you know, came forward, and it was very interesting that that probably the most important part of that study was that it seemed that the African runner had a much greater lactate tolerance. You know, he would not run quite as fast as his white counterparts, but he would be able to run at a very much higher percentage of his VO2 max for a very much longer time. And then I try to equate that to, you know, is there some way that we can intervene from a mental, emotional perspective, like we now know, you know, you can close a wound. If you concentrate on it, you can stop it from bleeding so profusely. All of us sitting here know that if you really work on lowering your resting heart rate, you can. You can consciously suppress your resting heart rate. And, you know, that's a pretty advanced skill, but, you know, we can all do it. So I think the four things that I came up with was one is sleep. You know, with the African runners that I've worked with, and Josiah was one of them when he won the Olympics, was when the sun goes down, they go to bed. And when the sun comes up, they get up. So they sleep a hell of a lot more than their white counterparts, you know, than their European counterparts. The second thing is they eat simply. They might eat, you know, a lot of fried foods or things like that, depending on what they can lay their hands on. But they eat a very narrow range of foodstuffs. They don't, you know, they don't go out for sushi, and they don't do this and they don't do that. They mostly eat, you know, the South African guys, they eat their maize meal and they eat a little bit of lamb and they eat a lot of tomato and they make this kind of stew. But it's the same thing day in and day out. They eat very, very, so I think their systems are very well adapted to getting everything they need out of a very narrow range of foodstuffs. And, you know, we did the blast test. Some of them get anemic and stuff like that. And our biggest challenge in Africa with talent identification is parasites. Because, you know, they have very low serum ferritin levels and so on because of the parasites. And so with African athletes, and I recommend athletes from all countries do that, because high-level endurance athletes travel so much, is to literally, I mean, it's kind of gross, but you need to deworm yourself every 3 to 6 months, you know, because they're... You often find athletes carrying some sort of a parasite in there, especially their iron suffers greatly. The next thing is that their perception of the sensation associated with high-intensity endurance work is way, way, way different. You know, we have it's fashionable almost in triathlon to speak about, I just went through the pain, and it was just pain. And they never even used the word pain. There's the race. That's the pace. That's the effort. That's what you got to do. You know, you want to bring home the bacon. That's what they don't talk about how hard a race was from a pain perspective. And when they start traveling a lot and they start hearing the other athletes talk about this, their performance suffers because they have something to bring into the equation why they didn't succeed. You know, when they get injured, they'll tell you this hurts. You know, so, you know, when I've done massage or something with an African runner, I don't find that they have a higher tolerance for a really deep massage and a gastroc on a quad or something like that. But when it comes to racing, you know, and I've ridden hundreds of miles on a mountain bike, on a racing bike next to them when they're doing tempo runs at under 5 minutes a mile. And the breathing is even, the rhythm is light. There's some conversation, even when they're going fast. You know, somebody farts in the pack and they all giggle. And, you know, it's way, way different. They're not so significant and so heavy about the sensations that they're experiencing. Now, right, whether so that's because they're lactate.
So world-class Ironman athletes, the older guys, you know, like Molina.
Yeah.
This is a differentiator.
Yeah.
this is why the guy's almost 50 and he can still beat people 20 years younger than him. It's because it just doesn't register.
No, it doesn't register. It's not an excuse. It's not an option. It's none of those things.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't show up. I had an athlete who had...
That might have something to do with your 1%.
Could be. I've had athletes run 209 in the London Marathon and have piles, you know, varicose veins in their anus come out and they're running with it like that. And I don't know... I've never had it, but I can imagine that must be the most painful thing on the planet. And they finished running a marathon in 209.
Yeah.
You know, so that's definitely a factor that's very hard to measure.
Yeah, and I think pointing out that it's a perception and not a tolerance.
Yeah.
That you're dealing with.
It's not like
poke a knife in you and I poke a knife in you and it feels differently. It's more like... It's just a matter of
how
it's supposed to feel like.
Well, we know that stress and, you know, and pain and all these things, that they are interpretations. The stimulus and the response to that stimulus is all about the interpretation in the middle. And their interpretation of these sensations, and I don't even want to call it anything other than a sensation, their interpretation of sensations of effort are way different.
Yeah, it's like a child falling down for the first time doesn't know it hurts till someone asks if they're all right.
Mm-hmm.
Crowds
mm-hmm.
around.
It also comes back to some of the advantages swimmers bring into triathlon, because a lot of these people, athletes, mm-hmm. were kids. So they grew up racing.
Mm-hmm.
So the way racing feels, and I imagine maybe the same with some of your African runners.
Yeah,
it's just something that's been with them as long as they have memory.
Yeah. It's amazing how myth gets developed around something. In South Africa, the big race that everybody aims at, and it became so massive during the apartheid years, is the Comrades Marathon. Mm-hmm. And it's a 55-miler. One year it runs up, and one year it runs down. And, you know, the guys are now running like 5:19 for that 55 miles. And
solid.
Yeah. And to train for Comrades Marathon... People will typically, the average Joe who's a 4-hour marathoner, he will typically run 2 to 3 marathons a month in the lead up to this race, you know. So the connotation marathon has been pushed down in terms of how hard a marathon is, because there's this twice and a bit marathon that they're aiming at.
Yeah.
So running a local marathon, you know, you'll show up in the morning and you'll have a Coke on the way there, and then you'll run a marathon, you go home, and then you start getting ready next week, you're going to run another one. You know,
yeah. That's ultra running too. I mean, that's the beauty of ultra running.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that.
You know, and then the last thing is they really know how to keep it simple.
Keep it simple.
They really know how to keep it simple. So, you know, that's why training camps work so well for them, because their lives can get complicated when it comes to financial issues. You know, there are a lot of people that depend on them, because they're people that are pretty high up on Maslow's hierarchy. You know, they're out there earning a living by running, so they have 35 family members that need money. So when you take them out of that environment and you put them in a training camp, and all they have to do is sleep and train and eat, just go through the roof. They respond very, very well to training camps. And that's why their training camps, like in Kenya and so on, they might start off with 55 runners. They're just looking for 5. And it's an eggs against the wall approach. It's just hard and hammer every single day. And in the end, there's 5 men standing. And you know, the Kenyans themselves will tell you that it's harder to make the Kenyan Olympic team than it is to win a marathon.
Sure.
You know, and to me now, the difference between the Kenyans and the Ethiopians, I think mechanics. The Ethiopians can change gears, the Kenyans can't. I really think that's the difference between Turgat and Gebre Selassie and so on. They rewrote the book on running sub 60 seconds, you know, 2 or 3 times in a 10,000, and then running like 151, 152, 153 for the last 800 in a 10,000. And when you watch them run, and you can see the Kenyans lope, and they've got those antelope legs that fold, and they can manage any kind of pace. And I think that's why they do well. And that's why I think a Kenyan won the Olympics. I don't even know if Gebre Selassie would have beaten him that day to run 206 in those conditions. Just so, so effective. But when it comes to brute force speed at the end, I don't know how we're going to find somebody that can compete with the Ethiopians. And if you look at the Ethiopians, they're stockier, they're stronger, they're more muscled than their Kenyan counterparts. So I don't know if that's a factor, you know. But they do keep it simple. Gebre Selassie's book, his biography, is out now. And it was written with the idea that they would call it the greatest distance runner ever, or the greatest runner ever. But it would be up to 10,000 meters because he was still running at marathons, and now he's rewriting.
Right.
He's continued to write the book on marathon running. But in there, he speaks about, he's just got these two workouts that he works on. They train on a shitty track. They know it hurts them, but that's the recipe. They have an old coach who's got very simple. They just do countless 59, 60, 61 second repeats up in Addis Ababa. And then they just short distance to travel. They get to go very, very high, and they do pretty much all their long runs at a kind of tempo effort, you know. And but when he speaks about it, I wonder if the guy that ghost wrote the book, or it was a biography, it wasn't an autobiography, try to explain something that Gebre Selassie hadn't given thought to, like the pain issue, you know. So there's these dramatic moments when he first broke 12:40 for 5,000 meters and stuff like that, which it sounds like they're putting words in his mouth. I think there was a serenity about how he did it versus how we would like to think he did it, that it was blood and snot and guts and gore. And I think on his side, it's a more serene spiritual thing that they're doing, you know. Anyway, so those are the three, I think, are the four.
Excellent.
Yeah, very good.
So,
appreciate that.
Thanks for dropping by.
You're very welcome.
It was great. Just give one little plug to your book that you've got coming out.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is, can you tell us a bit?
Yeah, it's Workouts in a Binder. It's a third part in a series that Velo Press is doing. The first one was the swim one, and the next one was the indoor cycling. And then this one's on running workouts, and it has training plans for 10K, 5K, 10K, half marathon, and sprint triathlon, no, Olympic distance triathlon, half Ironman, wow, and all just running programs.
Very good. Right there.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot for coming in and chatting with us. I was sitting here thinking about Bobby and the experiences I've had with him. And one of the things that I've always noticed about him is that he's clearly an intelligent person, but he doesn't have the presence of intelligence that puts you down. In other words, sometimes you go in and you listen to somebody who's smart and they make you feel dumb. But in his presence and you leave, you actually feel that you've been enlightened into something new.
Yeah,
and
nice.
I suspect that's what's made him successful as a coach as well. And along those lines, we're going to have him at the Endurance Corner Camp next July. And I think that you'll be able to, if you come along, that you'll be able to sort of experience that and
a bit of enlightenment.
Yes, and he arranges his own one-on-one consultations and that sort of thing. So you can check it out at bobbymcgee.com. And so thanks again.
Thanks, guys. That's very, very kind of you. And remember, you can become enlightened through a person that doesn't necessarily have to be enlightened.
That's it. Sounds good.
All right.
2 weeks from now, Greg Bennett, send your questions to JD if you got anything he wants to ask him. So thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.